Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons.
That America is waging a war against Islam, invaded Iraq because it hates Muslims, invaded Afghanistan because it hates Muslims, and that the only way to stop this war is for Muslims to start fighting back on all fronts against the West. And I became suddenly, I'm not just a Muslim in faith, I became a Muslim in politics, somebody whose politics were predefined by one interpretation of Islam.
What is your job once you join up?
To recruit as many people as possible to this group and spread this narrative far and wide.
That's Majid Nawaz, former jihadist, in an interview last night on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl. And well-educated, British-born and raised, domestic terrorism, but still with the face of radical Islam and jihad. We'll be talking about that and a bill in France that would prohibit Muslim women in that country from wearing the burqa. Here on this Tuesday afternoon, April the 27th, those two issues with Dr. Alvin Schmidt in the first half hour of the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Email us right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. A little bit later in the first hour of this Tuesday afternoon's program, Deaconess Pam Nielsen joins us. We'll talk about Jesus sending out the 72. That's Luke chapter 10, if you're following along. In the second hour of the program, we'll spend that entire hour with Professor David Lewis, Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, talking about the resurrection of Christ according to the Gospel of Mark. We have done Luke and John and Mark. I think we still have Matthew to go, if I'm not mistaken. Mark, in the second hour of the program, some real interesting questions about the resurrection account of Mark, because, of course, it comes at the very end of that gospel, and the very end of that gospel is a little uncertain. We don't know exactly where to stop. We'll see what he has to say about that in the second hour of Issues, etc. 1-877-623-MYIE, talk back at issuesetc.org, or Twitter us at issuesetc. Joining us to talk about a former jihadist and radical Islam domestic grown, Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College and author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
You heard Majid Nawaz talking about the narrative that is common in radical Islam, a narrative that talks about the West's hatred of Islam, which they would say is behind all of the incursions into their territories, they would say. What do you make of radical Islam's narrative?
Well, in many ways, the hatred is really the other way around. It is the Muslims or the jihadists who hate the West. I don't think you can make a very good case that the West is hating Islam or Muslims, because look at all the toleration that the West has, particularly since 9/11, given to Muslims, whether it's in this country or whether it's in Australia or whether it's in European countries like England and Germany and France. So it's pretty hard to make a case, I think, that the West is the one that hates Islam. The West is merely trying to protect itself from the jihadists. And jihadists, as the narrative indicates, are basically out to confront the West on the basis of a false definition. I think that's the only conclusion one can make.
What do you make of the fact that many, not all, but many of the leadership, perhaps the intellectual capital, if we can talk about that, of radical Islam is well-educated, in some case, educated in the West, either in Western Europe or the United States, and wherever they dwell, fairly well off, not kind of the typical picture of a Muslim's driven to terrorism because of poverty or oppression.
Right. The idea that Muslims who engage in violence are the underclass has simply been shown again and again to be very false. Many of these so-called converts from whatever they believed, if anything at all, in the West to Islam, in many ways you can say it was probably a form of rebellion. It was also in many ways, I think I'm convinced of that, it gives them a feeling of identity, of acceptance, which apparently they lacked. One sees a little parallel here between the so-called flower children we had in the 60s and the 70s, often called the hippies, who were out to find themselves. There was an interesting book published in the 1960s called Collective Search for Identity by Orrin Clapp, who basically argued that these people were engaged in seeking for identity and meaning in life, which a complicated, industrial, highly technological society often doesn't seem to give meaning to individuals in that society, and so they find some avenue, some organization, in this case with the converts to Islam in the West who grew up in the West, and is a case in point. Apparently, they lacked something that they found, thought they found in Islam now, by taking up its values, in many cases becoming jihadists, to destroy the culture that apparently they didn't like. That's why they left it. So you can see that aspect of it being involved, too. There's no second thought, I suppose, about destroying something that you really never liked, never identified with, and saw that perhaps as depriving you. I think that's the dynamics behind it, and I'm not the first one to suggest this.
What about the notion that a lot of these, not all of them, but some of them, are not, while they may be born into Muslim families in the Western world, they're not particularly religious to begin with. They kind of find religion along with the radicalism.
Well, that's a good point, because many times we tend to equate without any question or thought that all Muslims are religious. Not necessarily, as was revealed in the interview, he was there for political reasons rather than for religious reasons. And that's a distinction that I think needs to be made that is not made. We simply believe that if they're Muslim, they're seriously engaged in religious. But then there's also the other fact that we have to remember. It is very difficult to separate religion from politics in Islam. In fact, Ayatollah Khomeini said many years ago, right after he came back into power, then in 1978 or 79, my memory fails me a little bit, but 1978, I believe, he said, Islam is politics and politics is Islam. So it's very difficult to separate the two. And when you read Muhammad's Quran and when you read the Hadith, and it's very obvious that you cannot really separate the two. So when these guys say, I was in it for politics, well, in a sense, you might say in the Western society, it makes a little sense. But in reality, Islam too, because Islamic, the religious belief, tells the followers to confront, to annihilate the unbeliever. It even says in the Quran, do not make friends with Christians and Jews. Now, that's a religious value that has political implications.
What else stood out to you from the 60 Minutes interview with Majid Nawaz?
Well, there's a number of interesting things that kind of surface. Even Leslie Stahl, the interviewer, tried to somehow, I think, indicate that maybe he was just being cynical and whatnot. What is it? Is this cynicism in your part? No, not at all. You see, part of the problem we have in our Western society is ignorance about Islam itself, both political and religiously. As I have said many times, and I'm sure you've heard me say it before, I always tell people, please read the Quran and see the violence that is advocated in that particular book. And I've said it before, I do not accept the term radical Islam. You can say there are many Muslims that aren't radical. True. Then you have to also ask the question, are they really bona fide, genuine Muslims? Probably not. Because if you follow the jihadists, and for example, the Al-Qaeda people and the Hamas followers and the like, they follow the Quran chapter and verse. It is the others that don't. And so when we say radical Islam, we're in reality talking about genuine Islam, or the Islam that is conveyed in the Quran and in the Hadith. But somehow or another, you know, there was an interview not long ago by the on television of the son of Hamas, who, for example, converted to Christianity. He was interviewed by Hannity. And when he indicated, namely the son of Hamas, what was going on, even you could see Hannity was having trouble with it. And this guy, like I, rejected the term of radical Islam. And that's one of the things that we continue, even conservative commentators who, for example, on Fox News, keep using the word radical Islam. If it's radical, then you must say it's radical because the Quran is a radical book. But that you never hear. It's always somehow that the radicals are divorced from the Quran. That is really, you might say, a gross exaggeration or a conveyance of ignorance that somehow or another the media people and others have a difficult time believing, or maybe have never even probably heard it, but if they hear it, they tend to reject it.
When we come back from this break, more with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, talking about Leslie Stahl's 60 Minutes interview last night with former jihadist Majid Nawaz, and then a little bit after the break, a bill in France that would prohibit Muslim women from wearing burqas. This has been brewing for a long time in France, and there are reasons for it. The Muslims, of course, consider it oppression or discrimination. Is it? We'll find out on the other side of the break. We'll also hear the story from Reuters. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. It's Tuesday afternoon, April the 27th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Join us with questions or comments. You can email us right here in the studio. We'll get your email in real time. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Talkback at issuesetc.org. Twitter us at issuesetc. Or give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943.
Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of an Easter and Ascension sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Ascension Day, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Easter and Ascension sermons.
The CLCC has produced a new seminar to help people understand the structure of LCMS churches. So many people today are unaware of their church polity. This seminar can be downloaded for free from the CLCC website, www.theclcc.org. This is available for a seminar, a self-study, or presentations. And think about joining us. Members can download the PowerPoint version for free. Visit us today at www.theclcc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I attended Sunday services in a beautiful Singapore Lutheran congregation. One local man approached me and asked with a pronounced Southeast Asian accent, "You live in St. Louis? You know Todd Wilkin?"
Pastor Matt Harrison reading from his new audiobook, Christ Have Mercy, How to Put Your Faith in Action.
Who? You mean Todd Wilkin? It turned out this man, half a world away, was a regular listener via the internet, and he's hardly alone. It really is a whole new day. We are witnessing the greatest free flow of faithfully Lutheran information in the history of the Lutheran Church. It is the worldwide moment for confessional Lutheranism. It is Missouri's moment.
You can download Christ Have Mercy by Pastor Matt Harrison at cph.org. It costs only $10.99 to download. This new audiobook is a must-listen for Issues Etc. fans. Christ Have Mercy by Pastor Matt Harrison, cph.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest for another 10 minutes. In just a minute, we'll turn to the subject of a bill in France that would prohibit Muslim women from wearing the burqa or Islamic veils. Dr. Schmidt, before we get to that, both the story of Mossab Hassan Youssef, the son of Hamas, who we interviewed shortly after his book came out, and the former jihadist, Majid Nawaz, interviewed by 60 Minutes last night, these young men, bright young men, who both have come out of Islam, out of the terroristic jihadist form of Islam, and have embraced, in one case, Christianity, in another case, a more peaceful view of Islam. Does it give you hope for the future of Islamic relations with the West?
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough question. I wish I could say unequivocally yes, but I'm afraid it'll be a minority for the longest period of time and maybe always. I'm just not that optimistic. Why do I say that? Well, if you look back at the 1,400 years of Islamic history, that's what makes me say it. And the fact that we in the West are bending over backwards to accommodate and often deny our own values, unlike what we're seeing, which we'll talk about in a moment, relative to the veiling of women in France. That's what makes me very hesitant to say that I have a lot of hope. And I just have to say I don't have a lot of hope. I would like to be wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, we did also bring you on to discuss the proposed ban on burqas in France. Let's get more of this story from Reuters.
The battle over the veil in France. The French government is proposing a bill next month, which, if successful, will outlaw the wearing of the full veil in France. Mohamed Moussaoui, the president of the French Council of Muslim Faith, voiced his concerns to French Prime Minister François Fillon.
Nous avons fait part au chef du gouvernement de l'inquiétude des musulmans de France.
We told the head of the government about French Muslims' worries about the way the media deals with the debate over the full veil. The head of the government reassured us that the government wants to do everything possible to avoid this stigmatization and to ensure the planned law makes no mention of the religious aspects of the issue.
Et de faire en sorte que le projet de loi prévu ne fasse aucune mention sur le côté, si j'ose dire, religieux de la question.
France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, but only a very tiny minority, possibly as few as 200 to 300 women, wear full veils. Critics have slammed the law, saying it is an excessively cumbersome way of dealing with a tiny issue. The government says the ban on full Islamic veils that only show the eyes is a defense of women's rights. Supporters of the veil say the proposed ban violates human rights by limiting women freedom to choose how to dress and how to express their religious beliefs. Deborah Luderbeck, Reuters.
I guess a couple of questions out of this, Dr. Schmidt. Number one, why is the burqa or the full veil so important to some in Islam? And do you think it makes sense for France, for its reasons, to consider banning or curtailing its legality?
Well, it's important because these women have so deeply internalized that particular value, namely to completely hide their body from, and I don't want to, well, from leering men who may have sexual ideas. Muslims have for years defended that particular garb on the part of women, that it is something that protects a woman. Well, if that is true, then it poses a question, what are they protected from? Well, another question, obviously from males who, for example, do not care to discipline themselves in terms of sexual desires, but would perhaps even rape a woman. That's ultimately what underlies it when it says it protects the woman. They usually don't spell it out. And so, but in addition to that, many women have deeply internalized that this is part of their being a woman, failing to realize that it oppresses them in life in terms of just even physical movement. It oppresses them in life that it makes them conspicuously obvious in the eyes of others and in many ways constricts even their life. It goes really all the way. The difficulty goes all the way back. Even, for example, you had in the 1920s, Shah of Afghanistan told his wife in honor of the country's independence celebration to unveil herself in public. It caused such an uproar that the Shah had to backtrack and cancel various emancipation goals for women. And then, sometime later in the 1930s and latter 30s, the Reza Shah of Iran forbade the Shador, as it's often called, again, it's the term that's often used in Iran, for a woman wearing a burqa. And in 1941, he had to retreat from his decree. And in eventually, as we know, he got overthrown, and then Ayatollah Khomeini came into power later on. So it's deeply ingrained in the Muslim society, and it goes all the way back in many ways to Muhammad. Muhammad had, and the Quran talks about the veiling of women. It doesn't spell it out in great detail, but that women should at least in some ways protect their bodies from the view of men in the Quran in at least two different places. And so that's why a lot of women follow it. And I think, I have no evidence for this, but I suppose it's another way for those women who want to confront the West to do this, wear this kind of garb, in other words, to make the West feel uncomfortable and perhaps even get angry. And as is in France now, they're going to pass a law for women not to be able to veil themselves in certain manners, certain manner.
Does, with about 30 seconds, does it make sense to you for the French to attempt this?
Yes, I think so, because, you know, after all, we have laws against nudity, for example, against in every society. You and I can't just walk around in our birthday suit outside the house. So you have a law there in terms of how you need to be dressed. I don't see this substantially different.
Evan in Norman, Oklahoma, asks via email, is it an effective apologetic task to prove and demonstrate to westernized Muslims what their religion truly teaches? Your thoughts there.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly a way of defending Christianity apologetically, in other words, to make a defense of Christianity. It can be if we spell out, for example, in the process, which of course is not going to be done in France because France is a secular society, if we were to spell out how the scriptures do not demand that a woman needs to be veiled, and so in that sense you could say it may be an effective device to defend Christianity. It can also be, seen as an apologetic method in that it shows we as Christians or society influenced by Christian values do not or will not capitulate to values that we find morally permissible. And so to not argue against the veiling, you might say, is to become a partaker of people's error. In other words, that God, in this case, the Muslims would say Allah wants women to be veiled. And in that case, it would be good for Christians to say, no, we don't follow or don't agree with that.
Especially in that Western European context where the population density of Muslims is far greater than we experience here in the United States, mm-hmm. Is the veil, although it's worn by so few, is it also highly symbolic, a political statement?
Oh, yes, definitely so. I mean, I think that's one reason a lot of them do it in France. It is a political statement, and it's in sort of in your face to the West, and probably testing the West to see how much they can get away with.
Finally, then, what do you think will make of the law? I mean, do you think it will be successful, and what do you think the reaction among French or European Muslims will be?
Well, I think France really has no choice, ultimately. You know, it surfaced even in parts of the United States. For example, in Florida, there was a case a few years ago about a woman, and I don't know how it finally got resolved, wanted to keep her face covered in terms of getting a driver's license. So there comes a time it is simply not practical, and why do you have to have a face revealed in the driver's license? Well, obviously for identification purposes, which most people have no trouble with. But if a woman then can have her face covered, it obviously destroys the whole manner of identification, of facial identification. You and I can't step into an airport today or onto an airplane. The first thing you have to pull out is your driver's license with your picture on it. And if your face is veiled, well, that's no longer possible.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can purchase The Great Divide at our website, and when you do so, using the Amazon.com link at our website, issuesetc.org, A percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. IssuesETC.org. Click Listen on Demand. Look for The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam, and The Triumph of the West by our guest, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back, second half hour of the program, we'll spend with Pam Nielsen. We'll be in Luke chapter 10, almost the entire chapter there, dealing with Jesus sending out the 72. I think Luke is unique. I think I'm right. Luke is unique in this particular account, sending out 72 two by two. They come back pretty happy about it, and Jesus tells them that the true joy is not in the great success that they met with when they went out as the 72. That's on the other side of the break on this Tuesday afternoon, April the 27th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Join us with questions or comments as we teach a Sunday school lesson in the next half hour with Deaconess Pam Nielsen, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Email us here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org. Twitter us at issuesetc. In the second hour of the program on this Tuesday afternoon, we'll spend that with Professor David Lewis of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, talking the entire hour about the resurrection of Christ according to the Gospel of Mark. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
When the president of NARAL, a radical pro-abortion group, got off her train in Washington, D.C. during the March for Life, she was astounded by the number of pro-life youth. My gosh, she said, they're so young. There are so many of them. So she commissioned a poll of young people on abortion and shared some of the results with Newsweek magazine. NARAL found an intensity gap. Young people who are pro-life have a much higher level of passion on the issue of abortion than youth who are pro-abortion. The average pro-abortion activist is a woman over 50, and younger generations aren't following in their footsteps. According to Newsweek, young voters flat out disapprove of abortion. The challenge is translating this passion into laws ending abortion.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.